Hello and welcome to the Bear Mat Chit Chat and the second part of A Greener Future for the Green Oval. We pick up the conversation with Andrew Whittam from EV Land Rovers New Jersey USA and Dave Budge from Jaunt Motors Australia and talk all about the difficulties with one of these conversions, the rules and regulations these gents have to adhere to, the upgrades necessary for such an interesting new vehicle, and why you should consider one. Enjoy. So what are the toughest challenges you are facing when converting what is essentially an old banger from the 1970s into a beautifully restored electric Land Rover? Dave, I remember a video you made with a couple of challenges that you faced. But Andrew, maybe you could tell us what difficulties you have faced first off, and then Dave can see if he found similar issues.
Thanks for that question, because it is very interesting. The mechanical side of things were actually quite simple. Integration of the motor, etc., into the gearbox was quite simple. But the biggest problem, pretty much the only problem really so far, has been the use of batteries. Which batteries to use and how to store them and then fit them into the vehicle. We initially bought two sets of batteries to do two prototypes, one with Cowell lithium iron batteries from China, which is nothing wrong with whatsoever. They're very good quality, very strong, stable battery. And then I bought an entire Tesla battery pack of 16 Tesla batteries from a broken Tesla. And we worked out very quickly that we had to use a Tesla. The amount of energy in a Tesla battery is pretty much double anything else that's on the market. So to be able to get the amount of energy and therefore the range, we had to use Tesla batteries. That gives us other problems in terms of monitoring the batteries, because they're much more complex than a simple lithium ion. And they, in this actual instance, they need to be liquid cooled. So we have to liquid cool them. And that obviously increases a lot of the engineering requirements. So it's the batteries, I would say, were the biggest significant challenge.
And Dave, would you concur? What other things have you come up against?
I could tell a similar story. We did build a prototype, I guess a proof of concept more, it was with cowled cells, because you buy the cowled cells and you're like, well, we know we can make them fit in the chassis because they're, you know, little, if people aren't familiar with them, they're this sort of a small rectangular brick, very modular, whereas a Tesla is 30 inches long. I don't know the measurements in Imperial. You guys all use that. I don't know, 70 centimeters by 10 centimeters by about 30 centimeters. It's a big piece. So we bought the cowl cells because we knew we could create battery packs that fit no matter what, but we just weren't happy with the density, the energy density, therefore the amount of batteries, therefore the range. We weren't happy with the amount of manual labor that went into doing that. You're buying, for example, instead of using, say, 140 cowl cells, we would use 10 Tesla modules instead. So that's inherently less, you know, a huge amount of less wiring and less connections, even though you've got the liquid cooling and other things to deal with. So we now have standardized on that, and we use Tesla modules, and fortuitously, Tesla modules fit perfectly within the outriggers where the fuel tanks used to go on series Land Rovers. They also fit sort of two abreast perfectly within the chassis rails as well. It was like it was almost made to fit these batteries quite low and you know, in quite great positions. So that was definitely one of the things. Overall, you've got kind of a brand new system of predominantly new parts building the electric drivetrain. And then you've got the restoration of the old car, which brings with it, you know, obviously there's new Bear Mat parts, of course, but you're dealing with old axle casings and chassis and all those kinds of repairs. But that's, I guess, a known quantity. People have been doing this for a long time. Where that gets difficult is where you're connecting the old bits to the new bits. And Andrew mentioned the gearbox, and we're lucky enough to, I think you use CAN EV, adapter plates. There's a company up in Canada who makes adapter plates to go from a Land Rover gearbox to the most common electric motors. So it's an off-the-shelf part, and obviously that's got to be perfect. But then there's all the other bits to fit in, and it really is a packaging problem. While you're pulling almost everything out of the engine bay, you've got to try and fit a lot of batteries back in. So that's the challenge. And in Australia, we have to go through fairly extensive engineering certification when we modify a car. So if we're putting 20% more horsepower, 20% more torque into a vehicle, it has to meet a whole bunch of other requirements, plus also meet all the requirements that were standard when that car was manufactured. So, you know, 1973 or whatever it might be. And it has to meet all the standards around electric vehicle conversion that are in Australia. And those are, in some cases, very particular and in some cases, very subjective. So you have to work with one of only a few certifying engineers right from the start to make them confident in the workmanship that you're doing. That means that, you know, a battery battery pack, you're putting 100 kilos, 200 kilos of battery in a place that was never meant to handle that particular weight. So they need to be confident that you are supporting that in a way that is going to handle 20 Gs of frontal impact, 10 Gs of side impact. So we are forced in a good way to build a better product, because otherwise we could never legally put it on the road. And so there's a lot of documentation, a lot of work that goes into it that otherwise wouldn't. The early days of EV conversions were people doing some pretty crazy stuff out there in the world. They work, but yeah, building reliable, safe cars that are going to last for the long term is a lot of engineering. And I'm sure Andrew would agree, even though he's probably a lot more experienced at building Land Rovers than us. It's still a lot of man hours. It just happens to be that it all fits together pretty well.
Yeah, Dave, you're absolutely right. And obviously my experience in Australia, Australian departments are far more anal than, believe it or not, the US. But that's something that I've got to deal with in the near future. I don't think it's going to be anywhere near as complex as you have in Australia. But just to go back on that point about, you know, the restoration of the vehicle, it's just not financially viable, I've discovered, really, to completely restore a vehicle and do the conversion. So my strategy in the future, unless somebody really wants me to, is to buy or be given people's beautiful, well-maintained Land Rovers and convert them, rather than taking... I've got two others coming over from the UK, but rather than taking some gnarly old Land Rover that requires hundreds of hours of restoration before you even get to the conversion, that's just not viable for me as a business. So that's going to be my strategy in the future. And sure, Dave, you're aware that, you know, clearly aware that that's a huge amount of time and effort and money goes into restoration rather than the conversion.
Huge. And I think, you know, we agree, like the cheapest restoration you can get is someone else's labor. So it definitely makes it a lot more viable. And I think when we sort of talk about the cost of these cars that we build, and so probably on average for a complete rebuilt, I guess, remanufactured Series 2 as an electric vehicle, you know, we're probably talking about $150,000. Half of that is restoration and rebuild, and half of that is the electrification, roughly. So we do build full vehicles, but as we progress, and we sort of have a standardized approach on that, but as we progress more and more, we're working with customers who are bringing an already restored vehicle or are doing some of the restoration themselves. And so being able to work in, you know, different approaches to that, because yes, it is a very different commitment to people. I guess we're lucky enough to have customers who have come to us who would never have bought a Series Land Rover any other way. They see the shape of the vehicle. You know, you put a picture of a Series Land Rover, particularly in profile, and you write electric above it, and you don't need to say much else. It kind of sells itself. So when people see that, we're able to accommodate people who are just really, really come and say to us, "I just like one jaunt, please, and I want it in this color." And they're buying a electric vehicle platform with a Series 2, 3 shell to it. They may have never owned a Land Rover, may have never driven a Land Rover before. It is just the vehicle that they want. So for those customers, they're buying a complete car. And then we've got the other end where people are coming in who've had, you know, have many Land Rovers, want to buy, you know, want to perhaps do a conversion themselves. Yeah, all kinds of end of the spectrum. But yeah, it's... restoration of Land Rovers is a huge journey in itself. To do it properly, and once you start out and you know that the vehicle's going to be of a certain price anyway, you don't want to skimp. The customers don't want to skimp. You don't want to skimp. You need to build a great product.
I think it's a testament to both of your enthusiasm for the Land Rover vehicles as well that, as you say, Land Rovers really are not an easy vehicle to restore, let alone to restore and then convert. You know, obviously things like the power steering that you've had to overcome, and obviously with the weight, there's the advantage that the series vehicles have particularly heavy powertrains as they were, but, you know, obviously putting in the batteries and electric powertrain, things like braking, I know obviously Jaunt is working with regenerative braking, so all of this kind of technology, aside from just the simple drivetrain, is what's most impressive for me. Andrew, are you working with regenerative braking and putting the power steering in a similar way to Jaunt?
Yeah, absolutely. We're using NetGain Hyper 9 motors. I'm not sure what you're using, Dave, but
yeah, same thing. Plan. Yep.
And they're only, but the original motor was 67 brake horsepower, 485 pounds. And I can't remember the actual torque, but these Hyper 9 motors weigh 120 pounds. They're basically 100 horsepower. So there's significant, you know, good upgrade in the power, which I'm going to adjust the amount of power that they can use, which is done through the controller. So you're not going to get all of that power instantly into the drivetrain. But by the time you put the Tesla batteries over the top of the motor, it comes back to exactly the same weight as the original engine. So that's not a problem in terms of weight distribution. And I think that basically, by the time you take the gas tank out and all the other ancillaries, you end up with a vehicle that weighs the same pretty much. So I'm keeping the standard braking because the regenerative braking is so powerful that you actually don't need the amount of power in the front brakes as you would with, say, a diesel-engined vehicle.
Okay.
Because the braking, the regenerative braking, which is controllable, does create a huge amount of retardation.
That's really interesting. Dave, are you finding a similar thing? What's the plan? Juniper is now finished, is that correct? And you're obviously...
So Juniper was a 71 2A short wheelbase, and that was kind of the proof of concept that we built with the KALB batteries that we talk about. And she's actually... Oh, I can turn my head and see her over in the corner of the workshop completely stripped down. So she's not on the road anymore, but awaiting, I guess, our production spec components to be put back in. Okay. So very much a thrown together prototype, and then realized it worked and, you know, could give people drives. And then now we can really build them at a lot better quality. So that's about to go back in. But yeah, to Andrew's point, the regen is just part of the functionality of an AC motor. If you can just tell it that if it's not putting power out, it can just become a generator. So using the drive and the weight, the mass of the vehicle to create electricity. So gives you power back and creates braking pressure. We've just built, we just registered a 73 long wheelbase series 3. And again, yeah, to Andrew's point, same, I think within 25 kilograms of the original weight of the car. And we'd actually put a much heavier Australian military roll cage on the back and everything. So I think if we were just doing the conversion, it would have come underweight to what it was stock. We did that with the standard drum brakes, all new parts. But, you know, the long wheelbase series 3s had, you know, slightly bigger drum brakes. To pass Australian engineering requirements, we have to do a full brake test on that. And that means doing multiple drives at 60 kilometres an hour, braking hard, warming the brakes up, and then doing a brake test that requires you to only exert a certain amount of force on the brake pedal and stop within a certain distance at full capacity. So for a Series 3 two-door, that's putting about 900 kilograms of weight in the back. So we have to test it like it was a new car. So yeah, we put 900 kilos in the back, got it to full gross vehicle mass and did all these brake tests. The motor did it obviously fine. You hardly notice the power because the torque's there instantaneously. Now, while it can pass that brake test with the drum brakes, and the regen plus the drum brakes is actually a really nice combo because the regen can come on instantaneously with the pedal. You know, drum brakes can be, you know, definitely stop a car, but you don't get the feel of discs. But the regen can give you that feel back because you can tune it all in software. But what we're finding, and the reason we're actually doing a disc conversion on the front of all our vehicles coming up, is it just gives confidence to all the certifying engineers across Australia, because each state we have to get different certification. Sure. And if we can say, yes, we've gone from a motor that was, you know, 60 horsepower to 100 horsepower, that we now have definitely got better brakes. And as soon as you say discs, everyone goes, oh, yep, tick, and moves on. And now we've got that process pretty refined and those components refined. The man hours to assemble the disc brake system is actually a bit less than, you know, dealing with the springs and stuff of the drums on the front. So we leave drums on the rear, discs on the front, almost more for regulatory reasons than the fact that they're required.
I suppose it's difficult, really, because you are both trailblazing in this field. And so it's like anything, safety boards don't necessarily know what to make of it. And so, as you say, Dave, you're having to almost include words and names that they recognize in order for them to have the confidence in the legitimacy of the vehicles, I guess. So that's
absolutely
difficult.
I mean, there's so many little things that we have to do. We have to stamp an engine number onto the net gain motors. So the net gain motors are tiny, you know, they're 50 kilograms and kind of the length of your arm, a bit shorter. They're very small and they don't have an engine number on them like an engine would. They have a serial number as an electronic part, but we have to apply to the governing body here to get what is essentially a made up engine number that then gets stamped onto that, because that's the rules that cars have to have an engine number here. So there's all these funny little things we have to do to, you know, meet the rules that were written a long time ago for very, very different vehicles.
Yeah, that's interesting, Dave, because it's almost diametrically opposite here. I would love to put disc conversions on, and I'm actually looking at doing a disc conversion on a series, another just a regular one, because they're, you know, they're so much better, without a doubt. They're so much better and easier and simpler. But regulatory and liability, for liability reasons, I'm sticking with the drums at the moment, because in the States, especially safety aspects, if you start messing around with steering or, you know, braking, then you know, you come across potential liability. And in the US, it's liability that's going to kill a I would love to put disc conversions on.
We'll show you our disc conversion we're working on. It's going to be amazing. But it's an interesting thing because of the all the hoops we have to jump through and all the engineering we have to do to get these signed off by these certifying engineers. And when I say these, there's like, I think there's about 10 in our state that could actually do it officially, and probably about, you know, two that we'd have access to. So we have a great relationship with the engineer we work with. But by doing all of that, the liability falls on them. So it allows us to, while they force us to improve some of these systems, which is good in itself, it also means that we don't have, if we were to just do, we couldn't put disc brakes on or touch the steering without it being signed off by one of these engineers. But because they're signing off on everything else anyway, this stuff makes them happier and is, you know, is a better system, is a safer system. So by putting in an electric power steering system in, now what we have to do for that is we cut the steering column and weld in the column from the electric power steering system. And now at first glance, like, you're cutting up, you know, the steering column. That's the worst thing you could do from a safety and liability point of view. But yeah, we do that and we put a little keyway in it. We put a little rod through it, and then we have to go and get all that, those welds x-rayed and certified. And then it actually includes then a collapsible element to that steering column. So in every way, it's a safer and better steering system. We are forced to get it signed off, and then it becomes a standard thing. And even that collapsibleness of the steering column is a requirement when, again, we put more than 20% of power. These rules were written for kind of hot rod, you know, V8 conversions on old cars, that you got to upgrade the brakes and you got to have collapsible steering, because old cars used to, you know, you don't want to have an accident with a steering column coming towards you in an old car. So these rules that were written that we sort of now have to adhere to, but do force us to make the vehicle safer, and importantly, kind of puts the liability onto these certifying engineers, but they of course make sure that we do a really perfect job.
Yeah, that sounds really good, actually. You know, from an aerospace engineering background, I'm all up for that. But we are, you know, a very different system here, and it's and it comes down to, you know, individual rights, individual freedoms, as we all know from the news. And the liability is probably my biggest concern, actually.
So I believe Land Rover are formally committing now to launching 6 pure electric vehicles in the next 5 years or so. So, Andrew, how do you think your pitch will change with the arrival of new electric Land Rover models? Do you think the newer models will appeal to your market as well? Or do you think your customers are particularly attached to the idea of an older Land Rover with the technological and environmental advances that you are equipping them with?
My belief would be that the modern Land Rovers are so far removed from what we're doing that it's a completely different product, completely different market. Mm. And I'm not in any way disrespecting them. They have to do that. They have to make money. I even really love the new Defender. I'll probably buy one in 2 or 3 years' time. Surprisingly, I do like it. But I don't think it'll make any difference whatsoever. To be honest, I think these are so unique. They're so old school. You know, they appeal to people who already have fancy Range Rovers and top-of-the-line Land Rovers, but I don't think in any way that will make any difference personally.
Dave, is it a similar story for you?
I agree. I think, you know, the more electric vehicles come on the market, the more people are thinking about electric vehicles, the more they're interested in our vehicles. And the same reason that you would buy, you know, people were able to buy 2015 Defenders, but they still bought 1970s series as well and still drove them around. So I think that, yeah, until you can fold the windscreen down and take the door tops off and have no roof on a newer Land Rover, I think there's still a very unique place for these vehicles. And again, you know, we're not competing at volume in any way with any major manufacturer. We're not competing for the same market, you know, and that's not to say that for some customers, what we are building is what will be their daily driver and be their only car. But that's probably a rare thing. This is people's second, third, fourth, fifth car that they own. So I think, you know, more electrification is just better. More charge points, more understanding of the tech. I think it's great.
Certainly help you as well. That's interesting. I think probably my final question to you both is almost asking you for a sales pitch for those who might have been a bit skeptical clicking on the podcast and wondering about the concept of an electric conversion of an old school Land Rover. Why should somebody consider a electric Land Rover series conversion as opposed to a restored Land Rover series truck? Andrew, if we could start with you, please.
Well, that's good. Wow. I would say have all the pleasure and desire from operating a beautiful classic vehicle without the aggravation.
Interesting. Dave, what are your thoughts?
That's much better than I could say it. I'd say I don't really have too many words. But I agree, that's it, right? People want to drive these vehicles, and we see it all the time that people who've never driven one get in an original, love the look of the vehicle, love the idea of the vehicle. But these are engines that are 50 years old from a very, very different era, and we shouldn't and have all that enjoyment. You know, the feel doesn't go away, the handling doesn't go away. You very much feel you're driving a series Land Rover, but you don't have the exhaust emissions, you don't have the smell, you don't have the noise. What are you driving it for? You're driving it to get out into the countryside, enjoy all of that, and have it 100% reliable. There's one moving part in the motor. So turn the key and, you know, just drive and enjoy the vehicle rather than maintaining the vehicle.
I think that's perfect. I think I am, for my sins, part of probably the demographic that Andrew was talking about earlier, you know, the kind of woke Instagram obsessed generation where, you know, it is very much about the image. And one thing that I can certainly see being a market for your vehicles is almost kind of bespoke safari packages, whether that be Or, you know, in the outback in Australia or in national parks in the States. You've got this opportunity with these authentic looking Land Rovers that, as you say, Dave, make very little noise, do not pollute in the same way. So you could get up to the wildlife more closely than you'd ever be able to with a diesel powered series truck. You are doing it with a conscientious mindset in the wildlife that you're protecting by renting a truck of this kind. And that for me is one of the areas of the market that could certainly benefit from vehicles like this. I don't know what your thoughts are or whether you've even had approaches, either of you, from that kind of field. But I think that would be certainly a very useful application for something that's so quiet, but so iconic in an Instagram photo, if you like.
Yeah, that was my driver in a way. I wanted to drive my Defender at the time in the bush quietly. What am I there for? I'm here there to hear the, you know, the sounds of nature, to get out of the city. And I was the one making the noise. And so being able to drive around the bush quietly. And I think that the other thing is you realize, I mean, I started to become, as I started thinking about this, very aware of the amount of diesel fuel that I was burning to get to places of pristine, you know, air and that were pollutant free, you know. So I think that when you start driving an electric car, particularly if you're lucky enough to be able to charge via solar or another renewable resource, you realize that the cost that petrol diesel was, you realize the fact that you were just, yeah, literally taking this fuel and burning it, and what a waste. And suddenly you've got this freedom again to drive as far and as much as you want without any guilt on your conscience. Not that I think people should feel guilty about driving their cars, because what other choice do we have? But suddenly there's this, I equate it to, not that I'm old enough to have experienced this, but driving in the 70s pre-fuel crisis must have been pretty amazing, where, you know, petrol cost 5 cents and you didn't even think about the pollution. You could just drive as much as you want. It was this freedom. And I think that electric vehicles bring back that freedom of driving.
Andrew, do you feel the same?
Well, I do remember the 70s, and we never gave it a thought, did we? And I spent most of my career burning K kerosene and above the clouds. But I think for a market, and it would be lovely to produce some long wheelbase ones for the national parks. I mean, it's a pipe dream, but for sort of for the people to take one of these things into a national park. And the US has become very, very aware of noise pollution, believe it or not, and obviously hydrocarbon pollution. I think they'll be excellent. They'll be great. And I could imagine high-end parks, et cetera, possibly, you know, having these available to rent, to noodle around for the day in a park and see the wildlife.
Yeah, and we get a lot of inquiries around about that from all over the world. You know, there's a few electric defenders over in Africa that have been built in safari parks, but definitely that people are interested in that aspect, and I think see it as if you're building an ecotourism resort, if you're running an organic farm, whatever it might be, one of the biggest pollutants of all kinds, noise, carbon, is going to be the vehicles that you run. So we're even working with some builders, carpenters, commercial and residential builders who are B Corp certified, who are carbon neutral, and really most of their offset is in their vehicles. And so we'll be working with them to build some defenders that will be their true trade vehicles for that as well. So I think there's still, as much as we're building very emotional vehicles for individuals, because if you just do all the, you know, it's just purely logic, spending lots of money on an old series Land Rover doesn't always make sense, and probably never has, but there's definitely an application for commercial ventures as well. And whether that's in tourism, whether that's in, you know, that iconic look makes them an amazing, you know, brand vehicle. And I think a lot of people are, that's what we see, is that people are buying these because cars are a personal and emotional thing. And you want to be driving around in a big metal box that represents you and your values. And people, particularly in Australia, don't see any electric vehicles that fit that. They could afford a Tesla, but they don't like them. And they want a different kind of vehicle. And so we're seeing that. And I think that's applicable for all kinds of individuals and companies.
Absolutely. A greener future for the green oval, I think, is what we're looking at. So listen, gents, thank you so much to both of you for this podcast. It's been really, really interesting to get both of your perspectives. It's been fantastic to obviously be able to do it despite being in different corners of the planet. But I am conscious it's definitely meal time for Andrew, probably bedtime for me, and time to
bedtime crack for you. Yeah.
Time to crack on with some work for Dave. Thank you both so much. Definitely stay in touch, keep us updated with your projects, because we're very much interested in seeing how it progresses.
Great,
thanks for having us. Thanks so much.
Goodbye, bye.
Ladies and gents, thank you so much for listening to the Bear Mat Chit Chat today. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode and would encourage you to subscribe to our podcast wherever you are listening. We will be back next week with another engaging conversation. But in the meantime, we encourage you to stay connected with us on Facebook and Instagram, as well as our website, www.bearmat.com. See you next week for another episode of the Bear Mat Chit Chat.